Hello and welcome to Don't Miss a Beat, presented by Inside Cardiology. Don't Miss a Beat is a monthly podcast hosted by myself, Muthu Vadaganathan, and my co-host, Dr. Stephen Green, providing a regular news roundup of the latest evidence and clinical trial insights across cardiorenal metabolism. Hosted by practicalcardiology.com, Don't Miss a Beat is available on Apple Podcasts and Spotify.
Hello and welcome back to this month's episode of Don't Miss a Beat. I'm Dr. Steve Green. I'm joined with my friend and colleague, as always, Dr. Muthu Vadaganathan. And we're really excited to have this month's episode with you. Our plan today is to go over our ESC recap. And I mean, what an exciting and awesome meeting it was being in Barcelona in person. Heard there was over 30,000 participants in the ESC meeting. Cardiorenal metabolic disease was, of course, really a prominent part of this meeting. And of course, it was great to see so many friends and colleagues, including you, Muthu.
No, it was great to see you, Steve. And I think heart failure, if I may, took center stage. And it was a brilliant meeting and display of science and exchange of ideas. And, it has been years since heart failure has really gained the prominence that it has today. And it's hopefully something that we can continue to carry forward, not only in terms of interest from early scientists, junior investigators, junior clinicians in this rapidly expanding field. So I'm happy to kick us off. I'm very biased, but I would love to share and get the conversation started and gain your perspective on the DELIVER trial. And we were really excited to share this. We had unblinded the data several months ago. So we've been sitting with this data, trying to understand the data for some time now. And that actually helped us substantially because it allowed us to deep dive into the trial a bit more. Align the trial with adjacent populations, including other trials. So anyways, I'm happy to give a top line overview of the trial. It's a fairly simple design, 6,263 participants randomized across 350 centers in 20 countries, randomized 1:1 to dapagliflozin 10 milligrams once daily or placebo, followed for 2.3 years median follow-up. The trial's primary endpoint was a composite of cardiovascular death or worsening heart failure. Worsening heart failure is defined as either a hospitalization for heart failure or an urgent heart failure visit requiring intravenous heart failure therapies, a very similar endpoint as the one studied in the DAPA-HF trial, the sister trial in reduced ejection fraction. This trial enrolled patients who had an EF above 40%, had structural heart disease, elevated natural peptide levels, at least intermittent use of diuretics. And the trial was successful, an 18% relative risk reduction in the primary endpoint, about a 3% absolute risk reduction, translating to a number needed to treat of about 30 to 35. In addition, there were important reductions in secondary outcomes, including total heart failure events, as well as improvements in health-related quality of life, as measured by the Kansas City Cardiomyopathy Questionnaire. This is the KCCQ total symptom score with a average improvement between arms of about 2 to 2.5, with a substantial improvement also in the number of patients who had clinically meaningful improvements in the KCCQ as well. The trial had a 12% non-significant reduction in cardiovascular death and no significant reduction in all-cause mortality. The trial was predominantly conducted during COVID-19 pandemic, but even in-depth pre-specified sensitivity analysis essentially did not alter the results even after censoring patients at the time of a COVID-19 event. The trial showed tremendous safety and very consistent with prior trial programs of this class, and essentially showed no numerical imbalance in any of the pre-specified safety outcomes of interest. So on balance, I think a major success for the field, but I'd love your perspectives as you digest that data.
Yeah, no, I mean, it was very impressive to watch, and hats off to you and the entire Deliver team. And I mean, it really was center stage from the heart failure perspective. You had a whole late breaking session just to deliver. So really, again, hats off and really impressive data. I mean, the piece that I was really, waiting for was to see that very high ejection fraction group, the greater than 60%, or, previously, there was concerns about attenuation of treatment effect at the very high ejection fraction. And this was based on, sure, there was a post-hoc analysis of the Emperor Preserve trial, but also what we saw in the other GVMTs, ARNI, ARB, MRA, there seemed to be attenuation of the treatment effect as the ejection fraction got higher. So then we saw those post-hoc analysis, Emperor Preserve, and you're asking yourself, well, is this just a coincidence, or is this actually something there where there's something about these high EF folks where even the mighty SGLT2, might not be able to crack that nut, so to speak. But I'm really happy to put that issue to rest in my mind. Really no evidence of heterogeneity. The drug works just as well, and the ejection fraction is greater than 60% for the primary endpoint and the secondary endpoints. But what were your perspectives on that finding, Mutu? I'm sure you were waiting to digest that first and foremost, too, when you saw the full set of data.
Yeah, I think it was a critically important contribution of the DELIVER data was related to that high EF population. It didn't always quite sit well why this population of patients perhaps responded differently. And it made sense from the neurohormonally acting therapies, for instance, those ARBs, MRAs, even ARNI, that there may be some attenuation because neurohormonal excess does attenuate as well at higher ejection fractions. So perhaps using an inhibitor of that axis would be expected to have less robust benefits at that high EF range. But it didn't make sense for systemically acting therapy like an SGLT2 inhibitor. And so we were always curious whether those Emperor Preserve data were in fact spurious. And thankfully, we now have definitive data, including the totality of evidence, pooling the two trial results, showing that that high EF population similarly and robustly benefit from the use of SGLT2 inhibitors. So I think we can change our dialogue. One aspect that I want to put to rest that what did come out in conversations after DELIVER was that, well, now that we have a therapy, hopefully for all heart failure, irrespective of ejection fraction, well, could we get rid of ejection fraction? Could we get rid of the use of echocardiography to phenotype our patients with heart failure? And I think you and I probably, hopefully, agree that that is far from the case, and that echocardiography and EF assessment remain critical issues in terms of how we actually evaluate patients with heart failure. Not only because many of our foundational therapies do, in fact, have treatment modification based on ejection fraction, but also our device considerations, hints at heart failure mimics like cardiac amyloidosis or hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, rely on initial assessment of structural heart disease. And furthermore, I think it's a metric that has become ingrained in our decision-making and conversations with patients. Patients want to know how their hearts are doing, including in recovery and improvement. And we can talk about that population as well.
Yeah, I agree. That was brought up by the discussants, for example, a lot at the DELIVER late-breaking session. And I'm totally in agreement with you that I think from the perspective of whether or not to start an SGLT2 inhibitor in a patient with heart failure, EF, in my opinion, does not have a role in deciding whether to start the drug or not. But it does not change what we know about our other therapies for heart failure, where again, EF is very important for deciding yes or no for those therapies and also the value of those therapies. We just talked about the treatment effect potentially attenuating with some of our other neurohormonal therapies as ejection fraction rises. So I think, based on the evidence for the other therapies, EF is, while imperfect, it is enduring, in my opinion, for, our heart failure ecosystem and just standard of care. The other thing with DELIVER that you talked on and when you were going over the full results is the safety and tolerability. And I think then this point does not get as much emphasis as it should, in my opinion, because we're so used to seeing such great efficacy data. But the safety and tolerability of this drug, again, really stands out compared to some of the other therapies. And it's been consistent across all of the SGLT2 inhibitor trials in heart failure. And I think this point also becomes clear in some of the secondary analyses your team published with ESC. Patients where you might be particularly worried about, you know, safety or intolerability concerns, patients with severe NYHA class, patients with frailty, obesity, recently hospitalized patients, patients where, again, clinicians might have heightened concerns over safety and tolerability. There was no excess issues with safety or tolerability compared with placebo with dapagliflozin. And in fact, some of the patient-reported outcomes actually seem to have greater absolute improvements in these more debilitated populations. So the patients that need it most from a patient-reported outcome, quality of life perspective, functional class perspective, they actually stand potentially the most to gain in terms of absolute benefits with SGLT2 inhibitor therapy. But what are your thoughts, Muthu?
Oh, I couldn't agree with you more. And, you know, I think that when we think about patient phenotypes you discussed, some of those high-risk patient phenotypes like frail, like older populations. In addition, high-risk situations or settings like the hospitalized patient, and 654 patients in the DELIVER trial were either actively hospitalized or recently hospitalized within 30 days. And that safety tolerability profile was very, very consistent, including in that seemingly higher risk setting. So to me, this is a therapy that can really be safely initiated across settings, also across patient phenotypes, including in those high risk cohorts of patients. So a lot more to come from DELIVER. This is a large trial, and we are trying our best to unpack and disseminate that data as we understand it. So at the HFSA scientific meeting, we'll be highlighting new data as well, including in that important population with improved ejection fraction, which has not been previously studied in large outcomes trials. And just over 1,100 patients in the DELIVER trial had previous EFs below 40% who subsequently had some improvement, if not recovery, in their ejection fraction. We'll take a look at the safety and efficacy of dapagliflozin in that population. So more to share soon enough. But Steve, of course, there was much more at ESC Congress in the heart failure realm. So perhaps you can share a little bit about the ADVOR trial. It certainly created a ton of excitement and buzz.
Yes, absolutely. And so this trial was presented by Wilfried Mullins from Belgium. And again, a really important heart failure trial that focuses mostly on the in-hospital setting. Patients hospitalized for acute heart failure, we know hypervolemia, signs and symptoms related to that are really the central reason why these patients get admitted. And we also know from prior experiences that a lot of people struggle with getting decongested in the hospital. They leave the hospital decongested as well. And we don't have great evidence for in-hospital management with diuretics. You know, it's really a free-for-all and a lot of just clinician preferences and biases with what diuretic approaches to use and everything. So I think this trial was really welcome to try to have more of an evidence-based approach, you know, now introduced with in-hospital management with diuretics. So the trial included over 500 patients, so much smaller than DELIVER, but from an acute heart failure in-hospital trial, very, very sizable, more than 500 patients, all in Belgium. And they were all had signs of hypervolemia at presentation to the hospital, things that you would normally see, pleural effusions, edema, ascites. And what they were then randomized to was standardized IV loop diuretic management alone, monotherapy, which is really standard of care when you think about for in-hospital diuretic management, versus standardized in-hospital loop diuretic management plus IV acetazolamide. And it was a double-blind trial. And the endpoint the investigators were looking at was freedom from congestion at day 3. So the patients received 3 days of IV acetazolamide or placebo. And then at day 3, the primary endpoint was, again, freedom of ascites, pleural effusion, and anything but trace edema. They did have really important secondary endpoints, which looked at length of stay for the index hospitalization, because congestion oftentimes drives how long people have to be in the hospital. They looked at discharge congestion, so what people looked like when they left the hospital, and they looked at post-discharge outcomes. And importantly, they also looked at in-hospital safety of this approach with IV acetazolamide, because sometimes we're oftentimes used to thinking about IV diuretics in terms of risks of hypokalemia or other metabolic abnormalities that we have to be attuned to in the hospital. So really to understand, was acetazolamide well-tolerated from an in-hospital perspective. So to cut to the chase, the trial was overall positive for the primary endpoint of freedom from congestion at 72 hours. And there was 42% of patients free of congestion with acetazolamide at day three versus 30% free of congestion at day three with the standardized loop diuretic therapy alone. So again, it was clearly statistically significant, p-value less than 0.001. And again, I think it gives us now confidence in a evidence-based approach to a multi-diuretic approach for early treatment of patients hospitalized for heart failure. A couple other nuances of the trial, though, that I think are important that I think we'll need to unpack. Well, one was that just looking at the baseline characteristics of this trial, some of the things really stood out. This was an older population, so 78 years old median. Severe kidney disease was very common. 80% of the patients had a GFR less than 60. The median GFR was in the high 30s. So compared to some of our like large clinical outcome trials in heart failure, including patients that are hospitalized, these are, you know, again, seem very real world in those respects with lots of comorbidities, including CKD and older status. It was about 60% HEF or ejection fraction greater than 40% and 40% HEF-REF, but both EF phenotypes were included in the trial. The other thing to recognize, though, from the inclusion-exclusion criteria that I'm sure you'll have some interesting thoughts on too, Mutu, is SGLT2 inhibitor therapy was an exclusion from being in the ADVOR trial. So anyone who was on an SGLT2 inhibitor trial at trial onset, again, could not be eligible for this. And the rationale was really a couple fold. Well, one is that SGLT2 inhibitors, when this trial was first being designed, were not standard of care for patients with heart failure. And then the other rationale was that, well, the SGLT2 inhibitors also have kidney effects on the proximal tubule. And, you know, maybe two diuretics, maybe at the same juncture in the point in the kidney, you know, might not be appropriate. So I think that was kind of the rationale for why SGLT2 inhibitors were on the trial. But I think that'll be important as we think about applicability and just context for this trial. But I think those are the kind of the primary results. And Mutu, I know you were very aware of the ADVOR trial as well. So what are your thoughts on these primary results and some of the other data with it?
No, it's a beautiful summary, Steve. And I think it's an important trial. I recall something that stuck with me from ESC Congress was the mention of the magic of the proximal tubule. And I think that we saw evidence now from the SGLT2 inhibitors and with the acetazolamide, and is there something magical about the proximal tubule? Safe to say that it likely is a site in which has been previously ignored, at least in terms of diuresis and natriuresis, in which we can achieve those endpoints safely without substantial electrolyte issues or other safety concerns. And I think that this will certainly, hopefully, reinvigorate not only the clinical interest in inhibiting the proximal tubule reabsorption of sodium, but also maybe the scientific interest in understanding some of the mechanisms of benefit of these therapies. Until now, acetazolamide, at least in U.S. practice, has been fairly selective in situations primarily that where loop diuretics are precluded or hit a limit from being used due to intolerable metabolic alkalosis. But now this likely will position acetazolamide perhaps earlier in the pathway, not just in that diuretic resistant population, but perhaps upfront in combination therapy with diuretics earlier in the process. I think that, you know, some issues that did come out of the trial that still are a bit uncertain in my mind are the influence on perhaps more important clinical outcomes like readmission and mortality. And while, of course, these trials are nearly impossible to power for those endpoints, we would like to see those endpoints trend in the right direction, even with a short-term therapy. And so Here we see that at least at 30 days, a composite of mortality and readmission for heart failure, at least numerically, was higher in the acetazolamide arm. And I'm curious to hear your thoughts as to why that might be the case, and if that was indeed a true finding. Of course, it did not meet statistical significance by traditional methods.
Yeah, no, I heard the same thing in some of the discussions on the ADVOR trial, Mutu. And, it, you know, I think we have to remember back to the serelaxin experience is what I'll remind folks of, and the relaxed AHF trial, which was a trial of a very short-term therapy that we'll all remember, then it exerted these benefits on 180-day hard outcomes. So again, very short-term infusion, long-term benefits, got the field very excited, led to the production of the relaxed AHF2 trial, which showed no benefit on those same hard clinical outcomes. So I think to me, that kind of solidified the idea that it's very unlikely, in my opinion, based on our historical experience, for a short-term IV infusion to have an effect on longer-term hard clinical outcomes. And I think we need to have the same cautionary approach here with interpreting these post-discharge outcome findings in ADVOR here. I think it's very hard to imagine that short-term IV acetazolamide for 3 days would have a lead to excess mortality or excess heart failure hospitalization. And I think we have to, you know, recognize that this is a small trial, smaller than many of our clinical outcome trials, more than only about 500 or so patients. Did not achieve statistical significance for any excess risk. So I think we have to assume no difference there. But I think that's kind of the way I interpret all these kind of short-term IV therapy type trials and long-term clinical outcome trials. The one other point though I will say about ADVOR that I think did get a lot of attention from, and also is very clinically relevant, is that the protocol specified for it to be given very early during the approach heart failure hospital, not like as a rescue therapy. So it wasn't like you tried IV diuretics, loop diuretics alone, and then added this when you run into difficulty. But it was just that upfront, empirically, you gave this double diuretic approach instead of the standard monotherapy. And yes, this resulted in more congestion relief at 72 hours. But also, when people left the hospital, the people that got upfront acetazolamide still were more likely to leave the hospital decongested than the people getting standard care. So essentially, this tells me that there's no catch-up phenomenon really with this therapy. So it's not that if you defer it, it's not like you can make it up later, at least in this trial experience, by, you know, giving more diuretics or whatnot, that again, there was a durable benefit of congestion relief throughout the entire hospitalization. It persisted at discharge. And again, from other experience, we think that would be beneficial to patients from keeping them out of the hospital. And maybe if we had an adequately powered clinical outcome trial, maybe we would see some of these benefits on post-discharge heart clinical outcomes. But I think another important point to take away from ADVOR is that.
Yeah, that's a great, great point. And it was a fascinating finding. And so I do think this trial moves the needle in terms of in-hospital decongestive therapy, because for a large part, we've had large gaps in evidence for the strategies we employ on a day-to-day basis in terms of diuretics. So hopefully, this is, as was kind of put forth at ESC, the largest really acute heart failure diuretic trial, and hopefully will move the needle in terms of how we approach upfront therapy, upfront decongestive therapy. So I know we are at time, but I would love to get your thoughts on just one other trial called REVIVE. And this was a trial that we have been looking forward to, heard about for really several years. I believe the trial took place over 7 years. And this is a UK-based trial of patients with significant cardiomyopathy, EF of 35% or below, and significant coronary disease, at least 2-vessel to 3-vessel disease, and had other elements that enriched the population. These patients had viable myocardium, as well as were indexed based on the British Jeopardy score. That is, there was a large myocardium at risk. And so these patients were randomized to medical therapy alone versus medical therapy plus revascularization. On average, there was a median of 2 vessels that were treated with percutaneous coronary intervention and 2 lesions that were treated over time. The median follow-up was 41 months, and to my surprise, there was no difference in clinical outcomes across the board. There was an early benefit towards health status measured by the KCCQ, but in this unblinded trial over time, there was, at final follow-up, there was actually no difference in health-related quality of life. So on average, this showed that likely, at least in this selected population of patients, as was investigated, there was no incremental benefit with percutaneous coronary intervention in patients with LV dysfunction, heart failure symptoms, as well as significant coronary disease. So I think there was a surprise to many of us that would have anticipated benefit, at least based on what we've seen from coronary revascularization from the CABG approach, from the stitch and stitches experience. But Steve, what were your thoughts and at least initial impressions?
Yeah, no, it's certainly a hotly discussed trial at the ESC. And I think, you know, it's interesting too, that the deck was really stacked to hopefully have PCI show a benefit. Again, the viable myocardium, inclusion criteria that you mentioned as well, which again, theoretically, you know, again, would make you think that PCI might be able to exert a benefit. But it was also notable too, there was no EF improvement either with PCI versus stable medical therapy, optimal medical therapy. And so it'll be interesting to see, you know, again, if this will change practice. I think it is, you know, standard for us to look for etiology of heart failure when it's newly diagnosed. And that includes ruling out ischemic coronary disease. And obviously there is benefit for evidence for revascularization with CABG for these low ejection fraction patients. But now, you know, this really did not show that PCI for people with really, you know, sounded pretty severe coronary disease based on the Jeopardy score that's used in the UK. Despite the subgroup with very successful revascularization, where they dropped that score from being a median of 10 out of 12 was the median baseline, so had pretty significant coronary disease, treat those lesions, and it did not improve ejection fraction or the hard clinical outcomes. You know, again, we'll see how the field adopts this, but to me, it's kind of consistent with what we've seen with other stable CAD populations, with the ischemia trial, COURAGE, things like that, where, you know, PCI really hasn't improved hard clinical outcomes in a large clinical trial, to my knowledge.
Yeah, I think as we digest this information, key questions that'll come home is how we can juxtapose this information, if we should, with stitch and stitches. I think there are, of course, a number of differences. These were different eras of treatments of medical therapies. The extent of revascularization was also different. In REVIVE, there was really two vessels that were treated on average. In stitches, there were 3 vessels that were treated. So perhaps the completeness of revascularization. And then outstanding in my mind, and ultimately it comes down to every trial, comes down to patient selection. And it is, are these patients with significant heart failure with bystander coronary disease, or is coronary disease really the driver of the ischemic cardiomyopathy? And at least in U.S. clinical practice, it is routine to undertake ischemic evaluation, either with invasive coronary angiography or coronary CT upfront at the time of diagnosis of a cardiomyopathy or heart failure with reduced ejection fraction. And how much of that is contributed actually by the coronary disease is something that we guess at. And I think we have good surrogates based on ejection fraction, based on wall motion changes, based on CMR changes. But really, these are ultimately surrogates. And so teasing that apart will be something I'm hopeful that the investigators can help us unpack. And then finally is the complexity of coronary disease and whether there are subsets, including left main disease, which I was really happy to see them include. This is, from my understanding, one of the first trials that left main coronary disease were compared against medical therapy. And traditionally, it's a population that has been excluded because of the assumption of benefit with revascularization. So a lot to unpack still from, despite a trial of 700 patients, I think a wealth of information to come even in subsequent sub-studies. So that's it for this episode of Don't Miss a Beat. Steve and I again would like to sincerely thank you all for continuing to join us as we revisit trials as well as trial designs in contemporary fields of cardiorenal metabolism. Remember, you can find Don't Miss a Beat on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, as well as practicalcardiology.com, your home for the latest clinically relevant news and information impacting cardiology. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you again very soon.